Welcome to another edition of Rock Profiles, an hour-long look into the music, lives, and legacies of the classic rock musicians who defined a uniquely creative era, ushered in social as well as political change, and created immensely popular music that has truly stood the test of time. I'm your host, Maggie LaPique. Stanley Clarke is a four-time Grammy Award-winning composer, conductor, arranger, producer for recordings, film, and TV, in addition to being one of the most celebrated and innovative bass players of his generation. Stanley was a founding member of the groundbreaking and its enormously successful and wildly popular jazz rock fusion band, Return to Forever. Teamed up with George Duke in the Clark Duke Project and worked with a who's who of incredible artists, including Art Blakey, Natalie Cole, Maynard Ferguson, Aretha Franklin, Freddie Hubbard, Al Jarreau, Paul McCartney, Carlos Santana, Sonny Rollins, Ramsey Lewis, and Nancy Wilson. And that's just the tip of the iceberg in Stanley's amazing discography. Welcome back to KPFK, and welcome to Rock Profile, Stanley.
All right, how you doing? Good to see you again.
And great to see you. We began the show from the album Return to Forever, No Mystery, and a composition you wrote entitled Day Ride. But we're going to get into a Return to Forever in just a little bit. We're going to start from the beginning. Stanley, tell us about growing up in Philadelphia, your early music education in school, and your professional debut at 15 years old when you were invited by saxophonist Bayard Lancaster to join his band for a week at the Showboat Lounge.
Well, you know, at that time, Philadelphia was like a few other cities in the United States. They had a tremendous music education program in the city. I remember every high school and junior high school, they had like enough instruments for full orchestras, concert band, and a whole bunch of robes for choirs and all that. I mean, they really spent a lot of money, maybe too much, you know, but, you know, compared to now, which is like, it went completely the other way. No instruments, basically. But there was just a lot of, emphasis on educating kids in the arts. Obviously, someone thought it was important. I did and still do, I think. I mean, I probably wouldn't be here like I am right now if it wasn't for that, because my foundation, was at great teachers. I also, at that time, my mother supplemented my music education by sending me to I hated going to this place, but it's okay. It was a place called the Settlement Music School, which was a private kind of a music conservatory for kids. And it was, you know, it was a really interesting place because it's been around forever. Their claim to fame is Einstein took violin lessons there. It was like, it looks like you walk up there, you're expecting George Washington to walk out. Guys are there with white gloves and you're going very, very formal. But I had serious, serious education on the bass. And, it was great. Great time.
So after leaving, the Philadelphia Musical Academy, you made your move to New York City, where you got a chance to work with legendary artists like Horace Silver, who was a friend to this radio station, and we miss him so. Art Blakey, Dexter Gordon, Joe Henderson, Pearl Sanders, Gil Evans, and Stan Getz. How did you manage to land such high-profile gigs in New York City at such an early age?
I think the main thing was that I was really prepared. I mean, because I had all this formal education, when I went to New York, even though, you know, I played electric bass and I played acoustic bass, but I could read anything that anybody put in front of my face. I was really sort of a student of music and modern music or contemporary music. So I had that, but then I also had my own ideas about how the bass should sound, how a rhythm section should sound. I mean, it was a great time. The music was changing. It was somebody the other day played a record that I played on, I think it was called either Let Me In Your Life or This Is Your Life, an Aretha Franklin record. And I played on about four or five tracks there. And I remember that was a great record. Donny Hathaway playing piano, Bob James playing piano, all kinds of people. And as I was listening to that record, I was listening to the way I was playing bass. It was nothing really calculative. I was just playing the way I played, but it was a change. And you could hear the drummers, you know, I think Stevie Gadd was on some of that stuff. We were young, and so we had a different way of playing. So the music was changing, and it was great. I remember that session, Jerry Wexler, you know, celebrated producer. He was always aware that I was interested in equipment. So I remember the session, one of the sessions, you know, full orchestra, rhythm section, Aretha comes in like on a carpet singing, and they had the background singers, Sissy Houston and all those girls back then. And we did the record. When the song ended, Jerry said, come on in. A couple guys that were interested in equipment, he let us in, and that was the record. There was no overdubs or no change. Like, that was the record. And I tell you, I miss that in some ways, but I know it's impossible to bring that back, you know. But I had a great time. I tell you, those days for me was just cutting my teeth in New York. You know, with that way of making music was tremendous.
Let's take a listen to this recording session that you were just speaking of. Aretha Franklin, Let Me In Your Life. And Stanley, we'll hear the title track.
Yeah, title track, and it's interesting, the arranger on there was Spike Lee's father, Bill Lee.
Bill Lee. I want to remind everyone that you're listening to Rock Profiles on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, and globally across the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Maggie LaPique. My very special in-studio guest for this edition of Rock Profiles is the magnificent Stanley Clark. We began the hour talking about the early days, and we're going to move forward just a bit. We're already in New York, Stanley, and you started working in New York with Chick Corea. Tell us about how you and Chick met in Philadelphia and why you and Chick found such a musical affinity together and how the two of you renewed that collaboration again in New York.
You know, I met Chick in Philadelphia. I was playing with Joe Henderson, and Joe's piano player, I think it was George Cables at that time, couldn't make the gig in Philadelphia, so Joe said, we're going to bring this guy down from New York, and his name is Chick Corea. I had heard of him. I heard he had played with Miles, and I think he had one record, maybe two at that time. And so he came down. He came in his yellow Volkswagen station wagon, one of those yellow things. It was like a yellow thing. It was as bright as could be. So he drives down in that, and we play with Joe, and we kind of took over the stage that night. It's funny, sometimes when you meet a person that you really get along with musically, it's really something. It's kind of like a musical marriage. And so, you know, that night, I had this little apartment, and so one of the nights, you know, we're hanging out. I said, come on up, Chick. So he comes on up, and we just started talking about music. And again, it was one of those periods where it was just the opportunity for new ideas was just there. It was like this lane was there, or this path was there with nothing on it. And the path is saying, please, somebody walk on me. You know, and so, you know, we talked about, hey, man, you know, it's amazing. Wouldn't it be great to be in a band where we don't close our eyes and we actually look at each other? Maybe we write some music that we have to rehearse, you know, rather than just play some tunes. And then we had so many philosophical exchanges and things that we had in common. And we became buddies from that point on. And it's funny, after that gig, a Chick went away for about 8 months. He was in Europe. And he came back, and then it just started. Boom. And we never looked back.
So that's how Return to Forever.
Yeah. Prior to Return to Forever, we had a trio, Chick Corea Trio. There was another band that Chick put together with Hubert Laws. It was a couple things. And then all of a sudden, we thought, hey, let's put like a real band together. And then we called it Return to Forever.
So let's take a listen to A Return to Forever. We're going to return to the album No Mystery.
Yeah.
And I thought we would take a listen to, I just thought this was so hip. Chick wrote this one, excerpt from the first movement of Heavy Metal. Now, explain this to me.
The thing about jazz rock musicians is, or let's just put it this way, jazz musicians in general, you know, especially the ones that started out late 60s, early 70s, I mean, we weren't, you know, we weren't doing that stuff in the 40s and the 50s. So either way, there's going to be other influences there. You know, you like jazz, and you could put a suit on and wear a tie, and the apparency is that you've never heard anything other than what you're doing. That sounds like Art Blakey or Miles Davis, but it's not true. It's a lie. Because there were, you know, starting from the late 60s, there was other music that was popular. Motown. And so forth, all the way up to Parliament, Funkadelic, all the things. And so what happened was, it's funny, we used to get criticized for like selling out or this. And actually we were much more honest than the other bands. You know, I remember talking to Branford Marcellus one time. And Branford was saying, oh man, you know, we used to listen to Earth, Wind & Fire and dance to this. I said, really? You guys, you'd never know with them suits on. But, you know, we were just very honest and just played. And we loved to play music that, along with the techniques of jazz, but fuse it with other things. And so this tune here, I haven't heard it in many years. It's probably a song that, you know, Chick listened to rock and roll. He listened to other things. I remember Chick telling me one of his favorite artists was Ray Charles, you know. People would never know this unless you ask, you know, so.
Well, I don't know who said this. There's lots of theories, but there's two kinds of music, good, bad.
That's right.
And I'm into the good stuff.
Yeah.
And every name you mentioned, it's just, that's the stuff.
Yeah. It's music genres, are just, you know, sometimes because someone plays a certain way, it's because, could be their culture, their background, their region of the world they're from, their race. It could be, it's so many things. But, you know, in my travels, all the years I've been playing music and all the places I've been around the world, all the different musics that are apparently different. I always default back to this one Maya Angelou poem where she's, could have been her shortest one, where she says, you know, we're more alike than unlike. And that's just the way it is. And that's why music fuses. It's nothing technical or some kind of thing you're thinking about musically. It's just that people love playing with each other. That doesn't, what the guy sounds like doesn't matter. Can he play or can't he play? That's it.
Exactly. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from the first movement of Heavy Metal. And this is Return to Forever. And we have Chick Corea, Stanley Clark,
Al Di Meola, and Lenny White.
Lenny White. That's right, Vince.
Leonardo Blanco.
And we just heard excerpts from the first movement of Heavy Metal with Return to Forever. That is a Chick Corea composition. Joining me in studio for this Rock Profile session is Maestro Stanley Clark. We're just having a great time, and it's so wonderful to talk about these days. And we're slowly but surely going to kind of move through your vast catalog and career. We're going to have to probably do a part two down the road. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Return to Forever's first recording, which was on the ECM label. Yeah. But the follow-up albums were on Polydor, the label that released your first recordings as a leader. Why was Polydor the band's label of choice, and why was that record label the one that introduced you as a leader? Curious.
Well, that it was pure business thing. I mean, that was the company that gave us a deal. And, you know, we had like a production company that was with through Polydor, and they said, hey, let's record him. He's getting famous. Let's get him. You know, so it was, that's kind of how it was done. Polydor was a strange company. I mean, I don't think they had any clue what we were doing. I remember one time, they were owned by a German company, you know. I think they were a drug company, maybe the mother company. But I remember these guys came to see us. We were doing this big concert somewhere, maybe Munich. And this guy comes in and he says, he's talking to Chick. It was one of the few times I ever seen Chick, like, go down. He's always so positive. And this guy said, hey, you know, I love this music that you're doing, but you think you guys could do something like Disco Duck? I thought, man, I looked at Chick's face. That stuff used to always humor me. I was kind of, I get so humored by life and the strangest things, you know. And poor Chick, he had to bear the brunt of this guy, you know. I know he wanted to say, you idiot. But this was the head of our label, so he took it, and me and Lenny were just laughing on the side. This guy, Disco Duck. Come on.
Oh, Lord. I didn't know I was going to learn that about Polydor Records.
Yeah.
Now,
that's Polydor.
Why do you think that Return to Forever became such a groundbreaking and influential band, and what do you think its legacy is and, you know, sort of continues to be?
You know, it was an interesting thing. I mean, Return to Forever, we had obviously virtuosic skills. Each guy could really play their instrument. We, Chick was our fearless leader. He did the majority of the writing. I did some of the rest, you know, the rest of it. And then Al and Lenny would give things. And we were, you know, we just really made sure that everything was like excellent. And at that time, there were, we used to call them the five families of jazz rock. There was like Return to Forever, Mahavishnu Orchestra, Weather Report, Miles Davis, and we had either Larry Coryell's 11th House or Herbie Hancock. We would sometimes revoke the membership with Larry, but, you know, there were five guys there, five groups. And, you know, it was something new. I didn't realize it until many years later, but we were doing something that was new. It was kind of, it was unintentional. We weren't trying to do something. It was, again, what I said earlier. It was just some guys that were just very honest about what they wanted to sound like. People thought we were out there trying to make money, and actually it was the opposite. I didn't want to put a suit on. I didn't want to sound like, you know, my bass hero is Ron Carter. I didn't want to sound like that. Ron is Ron and Stanley's Stanley, you know. So, and I think all the other guys were like that too. And, you know, and I spent a lot of time listening to James Brown. I mean, you know, and I listened to, you know, all the blues guys, all the everything, Motown. I danced to so many beautiful girls with the Motown music. I'm going to put that stuff in my music. Why should I
restrict yourself?
Restrict it or diminish it? That was the thing that bothered me. I'm not going to diminish it. You know, why would I diminish it just to have a title or be a part of another group? So, and I think all the other guys were like that. John McLaughlin, when he came over, he was a great blues guitar player in London. He played great, man. When he played, I think, the record Jack Johnson with Miles Davis, killer, killer, killer. And so why would he just stop doing that to play like Wes Montgomery? It's illogical and stupid, you know. So we just did our thing, and it was one of those things that happened. It resonated with people, and I think people got that. I think all our fans recognized that it was honest. I don't even think they were thinking about what the critics were thinking about, like, oh, it's not jazz enough. It's always a few, like less than, you know, a percentage of just some people that have thoughts, you know.
Well, years ago, Joe Zawinul and I sat together and talked about sort of the evolution of jazz.
Yeah.
And he told me a story of when he finally got to New York and was sort of playing around, establishing himself, and a cab driver picked him up one night. He said something like, "Oh, yeah, I've heard of you. You're Barry Harris," or something. He got it somehow. And Joe was like, "What?" Yeah. It's because he was copying Barry.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe that was the pianist that he said. Yeah. And Joe said that he put all his old jazz records away, didn't listen to him anymore because he had to find his his own sound.
Yeah, you know, that's really cool.
Similar to you.
Yeah, that's cool that you bring that up because, you know, as you know, I do a lot in education and I have taught many bass players. Many bass players that you know were some of my original students. But I'll tell you something. One of the biggest questions that I get is, how do I find my own sound? And but the way the question is posed, it's like it's some mystical thing. It's not mystical at all. I mean, and this is in anything. The best thing to do, the answer to that is within yourself, is to be you. Unfortunately, because of commerce and peer pressure and all that, we're always, like when you go to a music school, if you go to a music school like Berklee or any schools in jazz, like you're going to see a large amount of kids are going to take the song Giant Steps, and they're going to spend 2 years learning Giant Steps just to post it once on Facebook and then go like, "Whoa, I'm something." You know, but the smart kid is going to be the one that just follows his interest. Everyone is not supposed to play like John Coltrane. You know, if a guy wants to play like four chords of blues, there's a reason for that. And it could have something to do with his personality, how he grew up, or how about just what he wants to say. He might want to say something that only requires four chords. But then there's the other guy that needs to play four billion notes to say whatever he's saying. And so if you follow your interests, and I've had a lot of success with students when I'm asked that question, you know, because it's not mystical. You just follow your interests. And everyone doesn't have to play like the Rolling Stones or like James Brown, or every black guy has to thump on the bass. You know, it's just you do like what you hear, go for it. And I believe that that's the closest thing to be you. Because first of all, if you do that, you're at a minimum successful as a person. It's just to be yourself.
Very, very solid advice for young musicians out there.
Yeah.
Want to remind folks you're listening to Rock Profiles on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I'm your host, Maggie LaPique. Joining me in studio is the magnificent Stanley Clark with such incredible words of wisdom. We're going to jump into School Days, and this is 1975 with the title track, and we'll be back. And we're back here on KPFK 90.7 FM listening to the music of Stanley Clark from his groundbreaking 1975 recording School Days. We heard the title track. To call it a success, Stanley, might be an understatement. And he wrote every tune on the album. Tell us what the inspiration for School Days, who played on the breakout recording, and your reaction to how popular, to say the least, that it became.
Well, that's one of those records and projects that kind of, you know, I think in everyone's life, maybe, I would hope, there's sometimes where you're in a situation where you have all these pieces, these moving pieces, and you have no plan necessarily, but for some reason, they all fall in place, but not necessarily the way you would see it. Like, for instance, the song School Days, John McLaughlin was supposed to be the guitar player, and he couldn't make it that day, so Lenny White introduced me to a guy named Ray Gomez, who happened to be there. He said, "Pull the guitar out, let's go." So we go in, and we play that song, and we did one take, but we did one take and a half because we started out maybe 30 seconds, and the engineer said, the bass drum mic is not working. We're at Electric Ladyland. So then we did the second time, and we just did the tune. So essentially it's one take. There's nothing else on it. And I remember going inside the booth, and there was a guy, second engineer. He goes, man, now that's a bass solo. That's a bass solo. And I wasn't used to the bass that loud on a record, I got to tell you. And I say to the engineer, who was Ken Scott, who did like the Beatles album, the White album, he's like a tremendous engineer. And you could do a radio show on him, because all the really serious jazz rock albums of Mahavishnu Orchestra, Billy Cobham, Spectrum, he did them. He was the engineer. And Ken comes completely from the English rock scene. So Ken has the bass just blaring through. Like, I said, Ken, man, hey, I like the bass, but man, please. And he looks at me with a deadpan, one of those deadpan English faces with the heavy, hardcore London accent. He goes, I can't even do it. He goes, oh, Stanley, the bass is never too loud. I said, okay. And, you know, it just sounded like something I had never heard before. And then there was a guy that used to be a manager at a Chick Corea. His name was Ron Moss. I said, I don't even know how to name this thing. He says, well, what does it sound like? I says, man, it's a great feel. It kind of feels like the way it felt when I was in school. He says, school days. And at the time, I wasn't aware that Chuck Berry had a song called School Days. So I called it School Days, and that was that. And the success of that song was actually was overwhelming for me. It's like today, I don't think there's a place on this planet where there's not some guy in the audience going, school days. I've been all through Africa, these guys, you know. I remember the first time I went to South Africa down there, and there's some cats in the audience, man. I just didn't think the record would make it down there, and that just people, school days. It was a great, great feel. You know, I still play it. For many years, I had stopped playing it, and because I felt, it's just too much. I've had so many different arrangements of it. But I just started playing it again.
Should we play one more track of School Days? Now, I wanted to play Desert Song because I just think it's such a beautiful,
it's beautiful
diversity of sound.
That was a beautiful thing. John McLaughlin, myself, and John plays so beautiful on that record. Wow.
You're featured on acoustic bass, John McLaughlin.
Johnny Mac, we call him.
Good. That's easier. Johnny Mac.
Yeah.
Acoustic guitar. And then we have on some percussion instruments, Milton Holland.
Yeah. And it was great. It was done in Electric Ladyland Studio. And that place, only way I can describe recording in there is it's magical. It just, for some reason, when you record in that main room there, whatever you do, it just sounds good. It's just one of those things that I could see.
Thank you, Eddie Kramer.
Yeah, Eddie.
Thank you, John Storick.
And Jimi Hendrix.
And Jimi Hendrix, of course.
You know, I mean, it just sounded, it's a great, great, great sound.
So let's take a listen to Desert Song from School Days, Stanley Clark. The name of the song, Desert Song, from Stanley Clark's phenomenal album, School Days, from 1975. The time has just flown, Stanley Clark, so we are going to make a date for a part two, because I didn't even get the chance to delve into so much, including our love of the great George Duke.
Yes. We got to come back again. We got to talk about my dear friend George. We have a lot of history.
Yeah, we miss him terribly, and and his spirit stays with us. And that will be down the road for another edition of Rock Profiles. We're going to end the program from Stanley's latest recording. It's the Stanley Clark Band, The Message. And tell us about this band and this young, amazing pianist named Cameron Graves.
Yeah. Yeah, Cameron Graves is an L.A. guy, and he's tremendous. He's tremendous. Well, on this song, he's featured. The song is called, it's actually a remake of an old song of mine that I wrote called After the Cosmic Rain. And now I added some more material to it. It's called After the Cosmic Rain, Dance of the Planetary Prince. Cameron has an album out called Planetary Prince, and he plays an amazing synthesizer solo. I was kind of burnt out on synthesizer solos from the 70s and the 80s, but Cameron has rekindled my love for that. So he came up with a great solo. So, yeah, if you could move the needle up to that thing there, yeah, it's great.
Stanley Clark, thank you so much for spending time today with me here at KPFK on Rock Profiles, and we'll definitely make a date for another session.
Please, please. It was great seeing you again. And I love this station. I've supported so much, and thank you.
Thank you.